The Lord be with you. We live in a culture that encourages us to avoid pain and manage risk at almost any cost. We're awash in advertising selling us painkillers. There's a market for every conceivable alternative to discomfort or soreness, aches and twinges and pangs. And never has there been such a selection of painkillers and insurance and topical numbing agents and diversions and distractions and balms and creams and pastimes and insulators and sedatives. And of course, our intoxicating little glowing screens. Each of these things seem tasked with targeting the nagging aches and sharp pains of living. Over the counter or by prescription, online, or wherever you can find them, just a little something to take the edge off. The church in every age faces its own unique challenges. So what could the challenges be of these times? A church immersed in this painkiller culture. This is a question because Jesus calls us to confront the powers of this world. And he asks us to do this without resorting to the world's tools or methods. So as a result, following Jesus will necessarily expose us to fresh challenges. As disciples, this cannot be avoided. These things are practically a certainty. What does a life of faith look like when we embrace the world and follow this path? Follow this Jesus with his hard call in our life. In Matthew 16, we witness Peter, the disciple, suffering an acute case of whiplash. It's a jarring turnaround in only a few sentences. In the space of six verses, 116 short little words, Jesus begins with, "Who do you say that I am?" And Peter responds with, "You are the Messiah." And even Jesus seemed surprised as he showered the disciple with blessings and appreciation. "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah. And I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not prevail against it." Simon Peter could not have known that he had just been chosen as the living representative, the stand-in for the great cloud of witnesses who would become the church in history. I mean, that's a lot to take in. What would it mean to be the first of Christ's new assembly of followers? You can hear him muttering to himself, "Whatever shape this is going to take, I'm literally in on the ground floor. I am the ground floor." What comes next as we follow Jesus on this mission? Oh, I'm sure this is going to be exciting. But Peter barely had any time to let these wild thoughts sink in. Because the thing is, Peter's recognition in chapter 16 would mark a turning point in Matthew's gospel. Because from here on, the Anointed One would begin to act with a new purpose, doing Messiah sort of things. Continuing to threaten the status quo, questioning the religious and political and economic powers. This was dangerous work. And this work of the saving one would, for Jesus, begin with a long walk to Jerusalem. The text tells us, from that time on, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and undergo great suffering at the hands of the elders and chief priests and scribes. Peter couldn't believe what he was hearing. "Jesus, we love you. The Messiah shouldn't be a victim. The Messiah is a champion. The Messiah is protected and powerful. Our Messiah doesn't suffer, at least not any Messiah that makes any sense to me. And surely the Anointed One doesn't die a terrible death at the hands of evil men. And what sort of maniac would sign up to be a follower, the founding member even, of a doomed organization called to a life of pain and suffering? Naturally, this is a big misunderstanding. Someone just needed to set Jesus straight. And so, freshly installed in his new position, the living foundation of the church, Simon Peter would blurt out the church's first official prayer. God forbid it, Lord. This must never happen to you. Jesus turned and said to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me." The disciple, understandably, did a very real double take. Now, there's a lot of room for interpretation in the space between those six verses. Between "on my rock I will build my church" and "get behind me, Satan." Naturally, most of us appreciate that first part. The pure gift of it. The Messiah inviting a regular guy like Peter to play a part in the divine project. And we embrace the implication for us because we get to be included, members of Christ's church. We get to be united with this called and gathered people, joining and blessing, a part of the crowd alongside Peter and the rest of disciples throughout all of history. We get to be a people named as followers of Christ, called to be alive and active in the world. But I think it's safe to say that most of us are just as uncomfortable as Peter was as he realized the path that Jesus had chosen. As the rest of us read what Jesus is describing as a way of difficulty and suffering, together each of us pray under our breath, God forbid, Lord. A sincere and honest expression of the church in the world doesn't get to stop after the first part. We are compelled to grapple with Jesus and this description of the disciples' life and what it means to follow him. How do we follow the one who says, "Take up your cross and follow me"? How do we regular mortal folks live such hard words? And how do us FBC folks in our little local church expression speak about such things? What shape might this give our life together as followers of Jesus? I'll start by saying this. I do know that many of us still bear scars because we grew up in communities which imposed on us a sort of grim spiritual self-denial, a practice that looked a lot like erasure of everything that made us a person. And so I say, may we be healed of those marks made of a distorted theology used to manipulate and control us, born of a failure of imagination. Because friends, together we follow this Jesus, and he calls us to be our truest and most alive selves. Amen. The other thing I'll say is that I don't think I need to say very much about those who have traded in the call to follow Jesus in exchange for proximity to political power or influence or money or the usual religious nationalisms. I think those of us in this room, I think, are more than a little shocked by this expression of church in our day. And if you're worried that this is an opportunity for the pastor to scold you, be assured that I have every confidence that this is a congregation that gathers each week because we want to take following Jesus seriously. We are a church committed to the inner city, and that means we already stick out our necks day after day. But by way of reflection, I think for our part, it's a good practice for relatively safe 21st century urbanite Canadians who live in warm homes and have stocked pantries. It's good for us to consider and reconsider and work together to strive for what it means for a church to stand against the forces who seek to dominate the land and its people. And it's a long list. The narrative of the unavoidable wheels of progress, the technological and political threats to human dignity, the desecration of our earth and water and air. Of course, we know the hungry people, those suffering addiction, the street folk who sit and rest and camp on our church doorstep, even the ones that we had to ask that they would move this morning. Are there ways that we might yet be called to stick our necks out a little further in service of people and places? What risks are we as a community called to take? If we follow the path of the one who confronted religious and political abuse, we will surely make enemies and encounter hazards on the way, and some will be more dangerous than others. As I was thinking about this text, so many famous Christians in history came to mind. I'll just share one with you today. There's a webpage with 826 pages of declassified documents compiled by the FBI. These are some of the documents gathered over the years of federal surveillance of the co-founder of the Catholic worker movement, Dorothy Day. 876 pages. Even J. Edgar Hoover felt the need to write about her and spread rumors about this woman. Apparently, the Catholic writer and activist was deemed a threat for her work with the poor, her sharp writer's pen, her anti-war protests and labor strikes, calls for racial equality and opposition to nuclear weapons, and of course, what are we going to do with a strict pacifist? I mean, may we have the courage to make such a holy ruckus as Dorothy Day. But heroes of the faith for us, they sometimes become larger than life. They don't seem like regular people anymore. They seem to be doing what they could to follow Jesus, but maybe with some sort of extra power or vigor. That's why I would encourage you to read the little book called The Reckless Way of Love, Notes on Following Jesus. And there you'll find a loose collection of personal reflections on this way of life, and one especially relatable snippet, which sounds a lot like a note to herself as much as to anyone else. It goes like this. Life gets harder. How hard it is to down the violence in our own natures, to be present and suffer and have faith and hope, and to keep an appearance of at least calm confidence that all will be well. All will be very well. Must read Julian of Norwich again. If a hero like Dorothy Day has days like that, then I'm sure we're entitled to days like that of our own. Jesus calls us to follow him as ordinary people, and this will always be a hard thing. The world will be cruel and heartbreaking, But what a gift that we don't follow Jesus in isolation. Together, we can attend to the direction and flavor and inclination of our life together. As companions, we get to discover again and again what it means to follow Jesus. What is it that we risk? What does this cost us? I think for Sartre, it does cost us some of our security, a portion of our safety. It costs us certainty and the illusions of control. And it will surely cost us more than that. Who can say? But as we let go of these things, we get to take hold of fresh possibilities. We lay claim to space where real human connection happens. We will share time with people who have been discarded. Those who we bless with our presence will bless us with their whole lives. Together, we get to unite our voices in opposition when called upon. Together, we get to share words of love and encouragement. And all of this makes the sum of our days well spent. I'll ask again, what will this cost us? That's the right question. What will this cost us if we don't follow Jesus in the world? What would it cost us if we kept things little and safe? What will it cost us if we avoid the struggle and the pain and the grief and the irritation and the annoyance? All those things that gather to make a reckless way of love. What will it cost us if we don't take part in the renovation of all things, one person and place at a time? God forbid this happened to us. God forbid. Amen. Thanks be to God.